You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, November 6, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Important because no one has slept in 3 days. Joining me will hopefully be a well-rested Ben Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also on the program tonight, as you didn't sleep, Biden took the lead in Georgia, Pennsylvania, maintains one in Nevada, in Arizona. And regardless, Biden will have won the popular vote by a margin greater than any Republican since 1988. And by the highest margin for a challenger facing an incumbent since 1932. Even if he doesn't win the electoral vote, that is the case. Although we could hear something any moment. It appears there will be dual runoffs in the Georgia Senate races, which will determine or could determine control of the Senate. Meanwhile, Donald Trump in a bunker claims it's all just a bad dream. Speaking of bad dreams, coronavirus surges out of control. 121,000 new infections yesterday. Hospitalizations are now rising. And it turns out counties with the worst virus surges voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump prepping for an insane lame duck session as if it's actually just his second term. Dem leadership in the House seeks to blame progressives for election failures. Mike Esper prepared to quit as defense secretary. And the cronies are seeking to flee a sinking ship. Meanwhile, a top NYPD anti-harassment official caught posting racist rants. Can you imagine? More than 150,000 ballots were stuck unprocessed in post offices. This is around the country as deadlines loom and, in fact, pass for these to be counted. Nancy Pelosi formally declares her intention to seek a second, or I should say, two more years as majority leader and speaker of the House. I should just say speaker of the House in the House. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. If I am seem a little bit out of sorts, it's only because I'm operating, like probably a lot of you, on a very limited amount of sleep. I am probably not as sleep deprived as some of those vote counters in Georgia. They were working through much of the night. And by the time we woke up this morning, Joe Biden had taken the lead in the state of Georgia. Our guest today, Ben Dixon, knows the state of Georgia quite well. So we will speak with him about that. And there's just a sense of people are just waiting for a call by the media. But it may not come until later today. It may not come until tomorrow. It may not come, may come in the next 15 minutes. It seems difficult to sort of sense at this point But clearly what has happened, and I think the dynamic that we saw in Georgia, and to a certain extent we see this in Nevada, we see it in Pennsylvania, but it doesn't seem to be drawing as much attention, maybe because of the votes that are coming in from Philadelphia. But the bottom line is that we all knew there was going to be a red mirage of sorts. And there was all there was a sense that mail-in ballots would tend to favor Joe Biden and the Democrats because it more Democrats were encouraged to mail in their ballots. And Donald Trump spent an inordinate amount of time saying that mail-in ballots were fraudulent or they wouldn't get your ballots counted. I mean, he was setting it up and hoping that would be the case. And it's quite possible that when Donald Trump essentially telegraphed to everyone that their strategy was to delegitimize mail-in ballots and to set up situations where they would not be counted after a certain number of days or there'd be discrepancies, he essentially warned Democrats as to what his strategy would be. And Democrats made sure to make sure the ballots got in there quickly and then started to encourage people, drop off your absentee ballots, drop off your mail-in ballots, do it much quicker than you had anticipated needing doing it. And certainly the dynamic in Nevada and Georgia was people anticipated red districts, districts that favored Donald Trump overwhelmingly in the day of election. They presumed that mail-in ballots would be reflective of that in those districts. But and maybe that's at first blush a safe assumption, but then you realize that, wait a second, it could be just that the people who are sending in mail-in ballots tend to be the Democrats. And so what happened in many instances is that Donald Trump did not nearly garner enough net positive votes from those mail-in ballots that one would have assumed if the mail-in ballots reflected the dynamic of election day. And in fact, in many, in some red districts, you had Joe Biden picking up votes, not a huge amount, but some from those mail-in ballots being counted because Democrats were mailing in their ballots and Republicans weren't. And so that explains it. Now, this has all been very difficult, apparently, for the president to digest, to understand. I'm never really clear if he really believes what he says in these type of press conferences, or if he's just surrounded by people who are telling him this, or if it's a strategy. But here's Donald Trump sitting in the White House, and he's a little bit low energy, folks. Wonder why, saying that you need to count all the... He's coming up with a new term for votes, legal votes as opposed to illegal votes.
Update on our efforts to protect the integrity of our very important 2020 election. If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes that came in late, we're looking at them very strongly, but a lot of votes came in late. I've already decisively won many critical states, including massive victories in Florida, Iowa, Indiana, Ohio. To name just a few, we won these and many other victories despite historic election interference from big media, big money, and big tech. As everybody saw, we won by historic numbers. And the pollsters got it knowingly wrong. They got it knowingly wrong. We had polls that were so ridiculous, and everybody knew it at the time. There was no blue wave that they predicted. They thought there was going to be a big blue wave. That was false. That was done for suppression reasons. But instead, there was a big red wave. And it's been properly acknowledged, actually, by the media. They were, I think, very impressed. But that was after the fact. That doesn't do us any good. We kept the Senate despite having twice as many seats to defend as Democrats, and in a really much more competitive states, we did a fantastic job with this.
There was no blue wave. There was also no red wave. We had a record number of people voting, frankly, in this election. Certainly, Democrats were far more confident that the stench at the top of the ticket in terms of Donald Trump would stink and stick to the Republicans down ballot. And it did not. And we'll talk a little bit more about that with Ben Dixon as well. But I think that's clearly a failure of the Democrats to tie Republicans to Donald Trump. I mean, it's a very difficult message to say, here's John Kasich speaking at our convention, a man who has no responsibility for Donald Trump just simply because that's where it landed for him, as opposed to the idea like this is a guy who is an important part of the Republican Party, and Republicans developed all the politics in which Donald Trump won on. But we will get to that. Here is Donald Trump also saying that there's something amiss in Georgia and apparently forgetting one important point about it. Let's play this clip.
The suppression. There are now only a few states yet to be decided in the presidential race. The voting apparatus of those states are run in all cases by Democrats. We were winning in all the key locations by a lot, actually. And then our numbers started miraculously getting whittled away in secret. And they wouldn't allow legally permissible observers. We went to court in a couple of instances, and we were able to get the observers put in. And when the observers got there, they wanted them 60, 70 feet away, 80 feet, 100 feet away, or outside the building to observe people inside the building. And we won a case, a big case, and we have others happening. There are lots of litigation, even beyond our litigation. There's tremendous amount of litigation generally because of how unfair this process was. And I predict.
Yeah. Well, 2 points, we should say that the entire narrative about observers not being in there turns out to be a total fabrication. That observers were in every location, multiple observers. In some instances, they had to stay 6 to 10 feet away from the vote counters. Can anybody guess why that might be the case during a pandemic?
The Biden crime family.
That's communist
China, yeah.
But the idea that there was no observers in there, we have many people who are inside saying that's a total lie. And the idea that the, let's say, for instance, the state of Georgia, where it's really just a race between Georgia and Pennsylvania to see where Donald Trump will first lose the election, I guess, right? It will first be most out of his hands. He should go back, check out his tweets from almost exactly 2 years ago, November 26, 2018. Real Donald Trump, Brad Raffensperger, will be a fantastic Secretary of State for Georgia. We'll work closely with Brian Kemp, Georgia. He is speaking of the now Republican Secretary of State for Georgia. In other words, a Republican who runs the election system there in Georgia. So Donald Trump in the throes, trying to accept the situation. Anybody can bring lawsuits, ladies and gentlemen. That's not indicative of anything. And those lawsuits are winding their way through the courts, and there does not appear to be any type of legitimate remedy for what they're talking about. The idea that you would go back and somehow figure out which votes were not observed and throw them out is absurd. But again, this is really just more of an aggrievement play at this point. There doesn't seem to have been any cohesive strategy to undercut, as much as it appeared that they were forming one, or they did have a strategy and it just didn't work out that well. can't tell everybody that we're going to challenge all these votes unless you get them in on time. And you can't tell them that if that's what your strategy is. You can't tell them in time so that these people get the votes in time. And that seems what happened. There does not seem to be any like straggler votes, except for ones that were stuck at the post office, despite the fact that the post office was under a federal court order to sweep all local post offices for any ballots and process them quickly. And about 180,000 turned up after the fact. They may be now largely irrelevant, but that could have been extremely messy. And I hope on day one, the Democrats have Louis DeJoy in there. I don't care what his position is at that point, and run through this whole thing. Some genuine accountability. We'll talk to Ben Dixon about that in a moment. But first, today's show is brought to you by the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Join them for a brand new season focusing on rebuilding America in a post-COVID world. In their first episode, they learn how to keep voters engaged once the election cycle is over and why that's important for democracy. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts or futurehindsight.com. Also, folks, now finally you can maybe stop watching the news, or at least shortly soon, on a constant 24-hour basis, and catch up on some of those shows that you have been wanting to watch. What's that? Oh, you turned on Netflix and it's not on there? It's probably on a foreign Netflix. How would you possibly get there? Well, ExpressVPN lets you change your online online location so you can control where you want sites to think you're located. What you do is you open up the top of the app, you select a location, you tap one button to connect, refresh the page to access thousands of new shows and movies. Choose from almost 100 different countries. You can watch Studio Ghibli films on UK Netflix. I am digging in. Apparently, the only place you can see like tons of Doctor Who. I know this may come as a surprise to people, but I am a little bit, I do, some of my TV tastes run a little geeky. Doctor Who, UK Doctor Who. I've opened it up and I can't remember what it was. Was it Romania or something? I was playing around, with ExpressVPN and found Mad Men in like Romanian, Netflix. It's pretty amazing. You can go check out anime in Japan. You can also stream in HD. No problem. There's no buffering. There's no lag time. There's no latency. Not only does it let you change your location, but also, as ExpressVPN has always done, it encrypts your data and lets you surf the web safely and anonymously. All you got to do is you go to expressvpn.com/majority. They'll give you an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Super easy. You can use it on your phone, on your tablets, on your computer. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn.com/majority. Okay, let's welcome to the show the proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show and the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show, Ben Dixon. Ben, Sam, welcome.
Sam, 1 second. Let me adjust my audio. It's doing something funky here.
All right. Well, this is all part of the COVID experience, folks, ladies and gentlemen. As we bring people in from their homes, but good, some people have nicer mics than others, of course, because Ben's doing a show. Ben, welcome to the show. Have you been sleeping?
No, not really. Not much. What about you?
No. I have. This is the way I basically do it. Is I say I've got to get to bed. I've got to stop reading Twitter. I've got to stop watching cable news. And so I go to bed and then I start reading Twitter again.
Exactly.
And then I wake up, and as soon as I wake up, if anything wakes me up, I check Twitter again. Exactly. And last night there was good reason to stay up all night. I know you are very familiar with Georgia.
Yes.
Have lived there at various times in your life.
Well, Sam, I appreciate you helping me with that, but I kind of had to dox myself this morning and admit that I am still in Georgia.
Well, all right. You are still in Georgia.
Yes.
There you go. And that's where it appears. I mean, all the action certainly happened last night. Walk us through this. And I mean, this is extraordinary because,
yeah.
And particularly, I mean, there's so much involved in this, not just the election, but also in terms of a message for how Democrats should approach elections yeah. going forward. But go ahead.
So of course, Georgia is turning blue. The count is not complete, but Joe Biden has the lead by a narrow margin. Some estimates say about 900 votes. And I think the one that most people are seeing is around 1800 votes, but it's razor thin. And so with that lead, it really comes as a result of years of organizing on the ground. I mean, there have been so many organizations that have put in countless hours registering voters as well as getting out the vote. And the organizations that have been doing the work here in the Georgia area, they have been extremely progressive organizations. The furthest to the right you would get in anybody here is Stacey Abrams. So, you know, if you think Stacey Abrams is a solid Democrat, every organization after her has been a left-leaning progressive organization, really pounding the pavement for progressives. And it's paying off. This would be the ball game if Joe Biden takes Pennsylvania and Georgia.
All right. So there's a couple of things to break down here, right? I mean, and you're emphasizing the progressive nature of these grassroots organizations.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess it's conceivable that they wouldn't necessarily be progressive. You could get, I guess, sort of like straight down the line Democrats, but you rarely hear about grassroots organizations for blue dog Democrats.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, it is in many respects almost an oxymoron. I mean,
right.
They don't they represent people who are not necessarily deeply involved in politics and certainly not willing to necessarily commit their time. It's a generalization. There are exceptions to that rule. But certainly when you talk about organizers and community organizers,
yeah.
They tend to be progressive to far more, far more to the left than progressive organizations.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say they are extremely progressive. They are some of the organizers. I know them personally, and they are much further to the left than me. Most liberals will call me a socialist. I call myself a socialist, but the organizers on the ground are further left than me. And I have to point out they are black. There are black organizers on the ground down here who have done an amazing job of black male voter projects, Georgia South Project. They are led by black people. They are run by predominantly black people because Georgia is a pretty black state, especially when you're looking at the Democratic or the left side of the spectrum. And the margins that are coming in from Fulton County, that's a predominantly black county. So Democrats, you're going to have to pay up for the black community because they are actually delivering in a very substantive fashion.
And we should again state, I mean, I stated before you came on, but this is happening in a Republican controlled state, right? I mean, these numbers, I mean, it's not like it's, Brian Kemp, and there has been a tremendous amount of disenfranchisement. So, you know, this is not there's a lot of headwinds that activists have been facing in Georgia. And the point of this, there's two different points of it. One is this is happening with almost at the exact same time in a Washington phone call, a conference call of the Democratic caucus.
Yes.
You're hearing so-called moderate Democrats complain about the progressive, like, and this is where it gets a little bit tough to sort of, disaggregate. Some of them are complaining because there were reporters on this call, and then they did reporting on the call itself, but there were literally reporters who are live tweeting it. And I don't think they realized this on the call until they started reading it on Twitter. Some people, we had Spanberger in Virginia, Abigail Spanberger, who was, let's be clear here. She was complaining that so much press was going to people like AOC. Now, want to remind people, AOC was like one of the top fundraisers in the House, maybe the top fundraiser of anybody not in leadership. In fact, I think she was. She may have been the top two or three fundraisers, and I'm talking for the Democratic Party in the House. But Spanberger was complaining about the publicity that AOC has and how much that brand is out there. Now, we also know that Republicans have a higher ID awareness of her than even Democrats did, or at least that was the case, I think, 6 to 8 months ago, because she was demonized by Fox News. Fox News has a history of demonizing women of color. That is what their that is sort of like their sweet spot for ratings. But Spanberger was also pushed out there as if she was the new national security establishment of the Democrats, or at least intellectually. And she was put out there as the one who really pushed Nancy Pelosi to impeach Donald Trump, which I think is a rather dubious claim. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people on the left pushing for that for a long time. But it's not like she's not getting press. And she's complaining that progressives are weighing down the ballot for people in places like Virginia. And but yet here we have a state that is not even purple, theoretically, and it is going to deliver the presidency. It could very well for Joe Biden. It's, you know, the idea that there's a runoff now for two senators keeps it into play, at least in the Senate, in a way a ton of different states didn't do. And this was a function of progressives doing the work.
Yes. Yes, absolutely the case. And I just, what is her name? Abigail Spanberger. She needs to know that there is no Joe Biden presidency without the left, right? Those of us, like, first and foremost, Stacey Abrams, I have to just give her a shout out. Like, I liked the majority of her work, and I think I didn't like her aligning with Michael Bloomberg, but that's neither here nor there. The fact that she helped organize and get funding for all of these organizations that went out there and did the work, and then all of the progressives to her left that got on the ground and did it. There is no Joe Biden presidency without it. And I'm sorry, Abigail, but if, wait, let me just, because I'm going to make sure I don't call her out of her name. Abigail, if you had that problem in Virginia, I think it's more of a problem of how much the people were drawn to you as a candidate. Because if we can flip Georgia, that hasn't been blue since Bill Clinton ran in 92, if we can flip and now the Senate seats, it's not just the presidency, but the Senate seats. And this state is the state that is going to determine the entire trajectory of this country. Then she probably is just not qualified to be in that seat. And perhaps we need to find someone better to run in that spot in 2022.
So one of these issues, you know, is this notion of ideology. And mm-hmm. and one of the things that also came up on that call was branding, essentially.
Yes.
Where there were some progressives who were saying, you know, why do we need to use the term socialist? Now, I happen to, one of the things that during the Bernie Sanders campaign that I was critical of was the way that he launched it in his, one of his early speeches, where he wanted to explain democratic socialism. And, you know, from my perspective, and maybe this is just coming from the experience of having done mass media with Air America, mm-hmm. and it being branded as, you know, liberal. And at the time, liberal was a dirty word from the right, not just, you know, it's become in many respects a dirty word on the left. But the idea of leading with that brand as opposed to just leading with the information, you know, comparing ourselves at that time, there was not much ideological media, as it were, out there. And the closest comparison would have been Fox. Right. MSNBC had not even really begun to position itself in that way. And, you know, Fox never, at least at that time, when it launched and for an extended period of time, did not said it was maybe a home for people who were conservative, but it did not push itself as conservative media. It was, you know, we report, you decide. It was,
I remember that.
But now, of course, all of their content was incredibly biased and incredibly conservative. But my point being that instead of trying to sell an academic concept to people, the, you know, in terms of like broad sales, the argument that let's say, let's not call it socialism, let's just call it Medicare for All. Because Medicare for All is very, very popular. across all cohorts. Let's call it an expansion of Medicare, which is hugely popular with older people, with not just with younger people, with older people, younger, anybody who's on it. Yeah. And let's sell these positions. Green New Deal happens to be very popular.
Yeah.
And certainly when you break it down and don't label it Green New Deal, it gets even more popular. The idea of like jobs guarantees and these are popular ideas. And the idea that they have to necessarily be sold as an ideology rather than I think, you know, a rather than like, here is our platform. I mean, I am far more open to that perspective on some level. But the bottom line is we know the right is always going to accuse people of being socialist anyways. They did that with Barack Obama.
Yeah. And Joe Biden, right?
And Joe Biden.
They've pushed this notion that Joe Biden is a socialist. And so here's the thing, though. It kind of is that kind of reacts to the framing that conservatives want to give in this country. And obviously, if we are negotiating on their terms, then we've already lost. But that doesn't take away from your first point about Bernie Sanders and the way he ran his campaign. And to a certain extent, it was almost like Bernie was running to expand the Overton window. But if you're a person who's expanding the Overton window, then you are almost making a sacrifice fly, right? You're obviously not going to be the person who scores, but you are the person that helps the team win. And I think that's what he did ultimately was expand the Overton window. And now we can talk about socialism or democratic socialism, because no matter what we do, they're going to accuse us of being socialist anyway. That said, I think it's also a function. It's an upcoming fight. The next fight, as soon as we get rid of the fascists and Donald Trump is gone, the next fight is going to be with the Democratic establishment, because as you stated, Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, those are extremely popular deals, like the proposals. But the people who will be blocking it are people like Nancy Pelosi, Abigail, I don't know her name. What's her name? Last name again?
Spanberger.
Spanberger.
Now, I mean, that's part of that's going to be contingent upon the Senate. They're certainly going to be able to posture differently if there's no if there's no Democratic Senate, because then they can actually sort of support things softly without having to actually have them come into play.
Right.
But the other issue with the establishment, and let's put aside like the branding and the ideology. And I think from the question of branding, yes, you can hone messages better or worse. I think, you know, regardless on either side. I mean, but the other issue is that the Democratic establishment has become sclerotic. They have been stuck in, first of all, it's not just a question of age, although that may have, you know, something to do with it in terms of like a ballast, not necessarily across the board. But it's also when people came to when they came into their own in what era of politics.
Right.
And you know, I want to put up this thread from AOC in response to what she heard, because part of it is also is the question of tactics. And when we talk about the establishment, one of the problems with the establishment is that it has built up almost like a royal court where there's a lot of people who are sitting there with their hands out, and their advice is often a function of what is going to put the most money in their pockets.
Absolutely.
And this is, I mean, it's not necessarily an ideological issue. You have people like that on the left, or supposedly, you know, on the left, who are looking to enrich themselves, right? I mean, we know this, but ideology does play a big part in it, because if you're coming from a community organizer background, if you're coming from a worker oriented background, labor oriented background, low income background. And I mean, you don't necessarily have to come from that yourself, but you work in that type of environment. The motivation of going out on the streets and community organizing, that's just not a lucrative thing to do. And so you have people, here's AOC talking about this right here, where, you know, questions of like TV. So she said there are folks running around on TV blaming progressives for Democratic underperformance. I was curious. I decided to look open the hood on struggling campaigns of candidates who are blaming progressives for their problems. And almost all of them had awful execution on digital, right? And this is just one element. I mean, she knows, she understands online very well. She's young. She grew up. She was like, you know, in many ways sort of trained natively in this because this is what, you know, people in their 20s and early 30s grew up dealing with in many respects. She's also an excellent politician, and she's really, really calling out the failure of tactics and whatnot. She goes on to say that it's a little bit tight. I can't see it that well, Brendan, but maybe you can expand it. Yeah, just a little bit and go through them. But the bottom line is she is talking about, you know, tactics and saying, people, you need to be more competent at your jobs in many respects.
Yeah.
Ideology and messaging are spicy conversations a lot of people jump to, but sometimes it's about execution and technical capacity. And the bottom line, Ben, and I think you know this, is that we have a lot of people who make a lot of money by putting television ads out there. Yep. We also had a situation this year, which was in many ways analogous. That's good, Brendan. You could take it down. Many ways analogous to what we saw in 2016, which was a lack of volunteers, which often comes from people who are not running on any type of like platform that it shows a real distinction from their opponent, that you have trouble getting volunteers in that situation. And that means you cannot go door to door. And I think one of the things that we saw again was that in places like Michigan and Minnesota and Georgia and in Pennsylvania, it was grassroots organizations going door to door, despite the fact we had a national campaign that wasn't doing it, that basically eked out this win.
Yeah.
And yeah. We saw a failure to do that with Clinton as well.
Here's what the establishment needs to be keenly aware of. This isn't 2008. The fundraising that took place that funded these outside organizations was not turned over to the Joe Biden campaign like it was turned over to Barack Obama. That said, no matter how much the establishment cries, they aren't going to be able to stop the progressive agenda and the progressive message. Their best opportunity is to work with us, because if they continue to position themselves like they have been since Tuesday, they've come out actively attacking the progressive agenda already, which I'm kind of grateful for, Sam, because it could let me finally be free to be me, because it took a lot for me in the last 6 months to not criticize Joe Biden and just focus on Donald Trump. So I want to thank Nancy Pelosi and all of them for letting me loose. But that said, they should really try to work with us, because if they work against us, they're going to see exactly how organized we really are and how much fundraising capacity we actually have. Enough to really primary the hell out of them. So I think they are really shooting themselves in the foot at this point. But I mean, far be it for me to stop them.
One of the things that I think is interesting also to look at is this notion of, and we should say Pelosi, you know, yesterday on the program, I had Jeff Hauser on, and we both to talk about how to push Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Even without a Democratic Senate, there's a lot of things he can do by executive order. There's a lot of personnel he can install without getting confirmed by a Senate. There's certainly Donald Trump has shown us that, even though they've been sloppy at times with it. But we're also talking about the Democratic leadership. Nancy Pelosi, in my estimation, and I think in others, failed during these 2 years.
Absolutely.
To deliver on even the very narrow promises that the Democrats made in terms of oversight and pushing the Republicans. And so this is going to be, you know, I think like as we're having that conversation, people, I got some pushback. Like, it seems a little early to be doing this. That hasn't been resolved. Nancy Pelosi announces that she's running for a second, or she's, you know, formally declaring. But there are moderates who are pushing back on perhaps on her. I mean, Some of this is generational, right? And just sort of tactical.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that the first pushback that came against Nancy Pelosi did come from the moderates. But, you know, if they open that door, they should be aware that we're coming running in, and there are going to be multiple challenges. Hakeem Jeffries is not going to get that seat unchallenged. I can promise you that. But it does represent a generational shift. Nancy Pelosi has held on to it long enough. And it also represents a shift in tactics. You got people like Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn, all.
Were you having a problem with Ben's feed?
Yeah, it looks like Ben might have froze out on us.
See if we can get Ben back here for just a moment. Nancy Pelosi, like I said, did declare formally seeking another 2 years. And one of the things that gets very little attention, I think David Dayen brought it up on Twitter, but part of the deal in her last reelection as majority leader and then ultimately speaker, that, or I should say speaker of the House, is that she needs 2/3 of the caucus vote, I believe, to get in, as opposed to half the caucus. And I guess the idea would be that would, the caucus would vote, and then they would ultimately all vote, for her for speaker. And I didn't see any mention of it in her letter, saying that she is, requesting support to be reelected as speaker. I hope that she hasn't forgotten that, deal that she made at the time. I imagine that, that Democrats remember, and we're just waiting. We'll get Ben back in just a moment because we have a couple more things to, talk about. This is going to be the nature of the fight, regardless of what happens with the Senate. Of course, if the Democrats manage to take back the Senate, it is going to be, a different dynamic. There'll be an opportunity to actually pass legislation. But if we do not have control of the Senate, then it's going to be a function of, I guess, messaging bills and perhaps, you know, an opportunity for Democrats to hold, Republicans to account for this past administration. Ben is telling me that he can do a Zoom on his mobile because the internet is down in his neighborhood. So, can you IM Ben that Zoom link and we'll get him on to finish up because I want to ask him about. Oh, here he is. Okay.
Sam?
Yeah, here we go. All right, great. Not quite as
good.
but you're still looking pretty good. All right, well, good. I'm glad you're here, Ben, because I wanted to ask you, you know, we're looking at what appears to be two runoffs for Senate. And before we get to that, because you're in Georgia, I want to get a sense of, like, you know, how much of a chance there is and what the value is of fighting that fight, even if the chances are very slim. But before we do, I want to just ask you one more question. One of the things that occurs to me is that about 10 years ago, I guess it was, maybe it was even longer, and I don't know how many people remember this, there was an organization called ACORN,
yes,
which was one of, which provided a lot of services for low-income people, but it also was one of the primary organizations, national organizations, that would organize low-income people to vote and to register. And the Democrats at the time were incredibly weak-kneed. You had, and it was when, you know, online campaigns were sort of a relatively new thing, and Project Veritas did one of their hatchet jobs on ACORN, and the Democrats immediately buckled and undercut their funding. And they were community organizations, undercut their funding. ACORN went away almost overnight. And I can't help but think that, and there were a lot of people and sort of like organizations funded by ACORN that had to close and sort of reemerge. And I can't help but think that what we're seeing now is sort of the rebuilding of a lot of that infrastructure that took a couple of cycles to rebuild.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not to be too corny, Sam, but like ACORN, the seeds, right? They planted the seeds and we are seeing it come to fruition because there was so much damage done by the fact that the Democrats were not willing to fight on behalf of ACORN. There were so many people who actually lost connections and roots to their ability to have resources poured into communities that otherwise were ignored. And the thing we know about the organizers here in Georgia, for example, they don't give up. Like they and they're not all young. There, some of them have been organizing for 20, 30 years. So I almost would guarantee that there is a direct connection across the country with people who were at least a part and aware of what happened with Acorn.
So talk to us about these runoffs. It appears that they're that we're going to have two. I mean, it's still possible that Purdue somehow pulls it out of a hat. And but I think at least the trend is that there's going to be a runoff. David Perdue, John Ossoff, yeah, and Kelly Loeffler, and Raphael Warnock.
Yeah.
What's your sense of the chances for either one of them? Does two make it easier for the Democrats to pick up one? I mean, you know, 49-51 is not not great, but
yeah, no, I think there's a motivating factor that is going to happen between now and January 5th, right? So it's going to be an all out race to the finish. Republicans are obviously going to organize and come out in droves. I think Raphael Warnock probably has the best chance because of the amount that Kelly Loeffler is unliked. She's really not liked in the state of Georgia. And she had a Republican challenger in the jungle primary, which is why she only got, I think, around 20 some odd percent, versus if she was running by herself, they would have secured that seat easily because there was nearly 10 Democrats running against Raphael Warnock. Joe Lieberman's son was one of them. So at this point, I think Raphael Warnock has a really good chance of winning the runoff because Loeffler is not liked. John Ossoff, he may just reap the benefits of being on the same special election as Raphael Warnock. Otherwise, I think David Perdue could eke it out at the very end if it comes down to a special election. But I mean, I don't want to dismiss Ossoff too much, because one thing he has the capacity to do more than probably anybody else in the state is raise money. He's able to raise a lot of money. And if he ever gets a chance to get back on the stage with David Perdue, I mean, he had that viral moment 2 weeks ago where he literally shut David Perdue down so badly that he canceled the third and final debate. So, you know, the young man might do an excellent job.
I money seems to me to be the least of concerns. I mean, I would imagine, right, there's going to be an enormous amount of money that's going to come into that race on both sides.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where, I mean, you know, like there's only so much money you can spend
between
now and then. So much of it, it seems to me, is going to come from what has pre-existed. You know, this infrastructure that has been built there, this organizing infrastructure. It seems to me that, you know, these groups are not going to be wanting for cash. It's really just a question of, like, can you get these folks who have been mobilized for, I mean, at least a certain percentage of them for the first time? Many, you know, have been just grinding it out year after year, waiting for others to join. But I mean, it feels like Georgia has hit a critical mass. I guess the real question is, like, you know, like, who will have the urgency? Because it seems to me, prior to 2018, right, and prior really till this era, Republicans generally overperformed in special elections and generally overperformed in mid-year, off-year elections.
Yeah,
I don't know where this one fits, right, because it's coming in January, when, you know, is it an, you know, there's, who's in charge enough for people to be rebelling against? Like, is it still going to be people voting against Donald Trump when they come out for that?
Well, yeah, no, actually, I think it will be. If nothing else, they'll be voting against Amy Coney Barrett. Right. They'll be voting against Lindsey Graham. There are plenty of villains left on the Republican side of the equation. They'll be voting against Brian Kemp, for that matter. All the voter suppression that kept Stacey Abrams from being the governor right now. Like, there's a long list of people that we are focused on in the state of Georgia that will push us out to the poll. I think the other question to ask, Sam, is who's going to lead the Republican fight? Right. If Donald Trump is on his way out, he's going to burn everything down on his way out. He's not going to be doing any favors for anybody. I just don't feel like he's going to be magnanimous enough to help out the Republicans when if he loses. And so then who's going to be the figurehead that's going to be able to push people? There's no heir.
That's a really good point.
Right. So without an heir apparent, they have no leadership to come in and mobilize people.
That's an excellent point. I mean, I don't know if I'm David Perdue or Kelly Loeffler, if I really want Donald Trump, particularly by January, right? Like, I mean, he'd have to be very well behaved for the next two or three months to come in there and not drive a tremendous amount of anger towards him and drive people to the polls.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I don't know. You have a better sense. Like, do you need a national figure to come in there? I mean, I imagine I wouldn't be surprised if Barack Obama not in Georgia.
We're going to have everybody from Joe Biden to Barack Obama to all the people who are still, for better or for worse, they're still great leaders in the Democratic Party. Who's coming from the Republican side, right? Who's going to be pushing it? Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, David Perdue, Brian Kemp. Like, there's literally no little Marco Rubio. I mean, there's really nobody who can come in as a leader. But Mike Pence? No. I mean, literally nobody. They're going to be bringing Candace Owens or somebody. That's how bad their bench is going to be between now and January. I'm sure they can rebuild, but not in time for this special election.
One of the stories that came out of the presidential election, and we should say, it is not over yet.
Right.
I don't think any of the court cases are going to have any resonance. But, certainly strange things have happened with presidential elections. So but assuming this holds, one of the stories is that Trump did marginally better with black folk. He did.
Yep.
Significantly better with Hispanic folks, and that, of course, is no group per se is a monolith. Although traditionally, black people have provided the Democrats with the most consistent voting bloc that exists. Hispanics, tend to be. Come from many different cultures as opposed to, or I guess more culturally identified or have different circumstances. Right. I mean,
right,
Cubans
right.
are more, I guess concerned about Castro or the
socialism,
legacy of
communism.
Castro and communism and socialism, Venezuela, Nicaragua, maybe. So do you think that Perdue and Loeffler have the ability to sort of peel people off in that way that Trump did? It doesn't feel like that to me.
No. So I do think, to be sure, I think the Republican Party has found a new way of they've solved a longstanding puzzle that they've had. Like, how do we actually get a diverse coalition without having to not be bigoted? How do we get black voters without having to stop being racist? Because racism is a key part of their Southern strategy. And they figured it out. You find and promote black people who will create a community that doesn't pose a threat to white supremacy. Candace Owens, all the different list of people I can name that are now the celebrities. And those celebrities have built a community, right? There are always reactionaries in every single community. There were conservatives, black conservatives, who never really cared about the racism of the Republican Party. They just didn't have anywhere to be identified with. Like, they didn't have anyone that they could connect with and be out loud and proud. Now they have their conferences. Now they have their online media presences. They have places they can go and connect with other black reactionaries. You're going to have black fascists, right? Let's just cut to the core. Black patriarchy. I mean, there's all kinds of things in the black community. And now they finally have a home. Republicans will capitalize on that going in the future. I don't think it will be a factor at all in January, though.
Ben Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show. Good luck with that internet connection there. I appreciate your calling in by phone. Thanks so much for your time today, man.
Appreciate you, man. Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more and close this out. So one of the things, too, I think that should be deployed during that that special election that Democrats might be able to get like a big twofer out of is the notion of the coronavirus and the corruption involved in the insider trading that Lafler was involved in and Perdue was involved in. Remember that clip? Matt, Brendan, you remember that clip, and I think Ben mentioned it, where Ossoff basically really dug into David Perdue hard on his corruption, called him a crook, so much so that David Perdue canceled their second debate. Now, I don't know if they're going to have another debate, but, you know, for Ossoff to have an entire campaign for now until January, just about 2.5 months, maybe 2 months, built upon the idea of A, that Perdue is corrupt, and B, that he's so corrupt that he was afraid to face the music again. That to me seems pretty powerful. And then Loeffler has a similar problem. I have a feeling that Doug Collins, who was her main challenger, probably cut an ad or two along those lines. There may be a twofer type of opportunity here for Democrats in Georgia, where you're cutting ads talking about these two corrupt senators coming from Georgia. And I will say, you know, we're looking at 122,000 new infections yesterday in this country. Health policy folks, epidemiologists are saying we are really on, I mean, I think we may be, in their perspective, beyond the brink in terms of COVID exploding. We're 3 weeks out from Thanksgiving, where we know people are going to be traveling. We have areas of the country where they just completely deny that it exists. AP has a report that shows that counties with the worst virus, 376 counties with the highest number of new cases per capita, the overwhelming majority, 93% of those counties went for Trump. Montana, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Wisconsin. They have lower rates of adherence to social distancing and mask wearing, other public health measures. We could see this explode. And with that backdrop, and two senators who saw coronavirus as an opportunity to pad their pockets with cash may prove to be very powerful. I mean, make no mistake about it. Georgia is an uphill battle still. And certainly when you're talking about not top of the ticket and you're talking about someone not as odious as Donald Trump, but there's an opportunity here. And there is a world of difference between a Biden presidency with a democratically controlled Senate and a Biden presidency without one, both in terms of like what can actually happen to help people and what can be done in terms of progressives pushing their democratic elected officials. We will talk about that more in the coming weeks, particularly on Monday and beyond. In the meantime, those of you folks who are sticking around, going to head to the fun half. Emma's going to join us. Want to remind you, you can tune in to Nomi's show today at 3 p.m. You can find her show at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And your support is what keeps this program alive. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do so, you're supporting the free show, and then we give you extra content. Sometimes we give you 13 hours. Well, wait, what did we do on Tuesday? 13 and a half hours?
That was just what was on air, too.
We need to cut up some of those videos. Gotta get Dorsey on that. But
the Hillary Clinton cameo.
Oh my God. Yes. Oof. That was one of the most disturbing things. It's hard. I don't, you know, we had, how many guests did you say we had on that show?
Close to 20.
That was nuts. I think I did a pretty good job of not drinking too much during that. I don't think I would have been able to make it if I had.
I think it. When we're all in the studio together, drinks kind of happen a bit faster. It seems like I haven't been drinking as much here in the studio anyway.
That's true. In the studio, I mean, I was in studio, but I think because there was an absence of people around me drinking a lot, and there was no one to bring me drinks. Brendan sometimes is just right, is, you know, Johnny on the spot with that. But I would have been a wreck, I think, had I been drinking. But it appears that at the very least, it's not the election was not a failure. I am very, very relieved to not have Donald Trump as the president, but not so relieved as to not want to push. And I think, you know, one of the things too, and maybe we'll talk about this in the fun half. There is people are on top of it, you know, and maybe in some ways, I think like this slow roll with Biden is healthy for that. But we'll talk more about that in the fun half. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie. You can find that at amquickie.com. Shop.majorityreportradio.com for our merch. I know I got to do a better job of like displaying the merch. Like maybe I should wear it on camera once or have a pencil. I haven't gotten my pencils yet, Brendan. I don't think I've gotten any Carpenter pencils.
They didn't send you any?
No. Ugh. Yeah. I don't think, no. And, you can get Carpenter pencils over there. Also, don't forget, the Antifada, patreon.com/theAntifada, all new shows this week. Matt, TMBS, what's on the docket for TMBS?
Yeah, we did a reaction stream on Wednesday night, I think it was, and David Griscom's going to be doing sort of ad hoc streams as things develop, probably today and over the weekend.
Fantastic. All right. Quick break. Fun half. 646-257-3920. We'll try and do some calls. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.